If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Go and KQEI North Highland, Sacramento.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals who want to join an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
On the program today, the bond market, AI, small businesses, and Botox, in that order. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bitwarden, with a reminder that strengthening account security with a password manager can help users stay safer on all devices during this season of giving and all year long. Learn more at bitwarden.com. And by Ninja One, helping organizations manage, protect, and support every device and every user, all from one platform that automates IT and strengthens security. More at ninjaone.com. And by Solidigm. Today's AI ambitions require a different approach to storage. Solidigm offers solid-state storage solutions optimized for AI with higher capacities, greater speed, and energy efficiency. StorageForAI.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 9th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We all want to know which way the economy's going, right? I think that's a pretty uncontroversial thing to say. And to find out, you could, for instance, ask an economist friend what they think, maybe a Wall Street banker if you know one, or better yet, a small business person. You could also clue into the Federal Reserve tomorrow when the central bank is going to release its summary of economic projections where they think rates and a bunch of other parameters are headed. You could also, though, if you are of a mind, look at the bond market. Demand for short-term treasury bills and longer-term bonds at either end of what is known as the yield curve can tell us a lot about what investors are expecting. But there is a part of that yield curve that we don't often talk about. Medium-term treasury, sometimes known as the belly of the curve. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports now to get us going, that belly has been sending some signals of its own.
The government issues treasuries that mature in anywhere from less than a year to 10 and even 30 years. So the belly of the curve is basically everything in the middle.
We tend to focus on 2-year and 5-year notes.
That's Chris Lowe, chief economist at FHN Financial. He says yields on treasuries in that belly of the curve are influenced by what investors expect the Federal Reserve to do in that 2 to 5-year time frame.
They anticipate. So when we talk about the Fed might cut rates at an upcoming meeting or they might not, well, we're anticipating not just the next one, but the next several years worth.
Investors know that the Federal Reserve is still trying to bring rates down to a neutral level to support full employment and stable inflation. And if investors think interest rates are going to keep falling, they're more likely to buy those bonds today. But Lowe says over the last couple of weeks, demand for treasuries within that belly of the curve has eased off a bit.
When we look at the pricing of interest rates in the belly of the curve, it partly reflects a debate within the trading community, within the Federal Reserve itself, about just exactly where is neutral.
Over the last couple months, expectations for economic growth have picked up. John Canavan, lead market analyst at Oxford Economics, says the tax incentives in the budget law passed this year are expected to stimulate consumer spending.
That same act has also resulted in significant investment benefits for corporations, which is likely to improve capital expenditures next year, which should help economic growth.
And if economic growth continues to pick up and inflation sticks around?
That actually means the Fed is likely to cut rates, you know, less.
That's Kathy Bosjancic, chief economist at Nationwide. She says bond markets are only expecting 2 cuts next year. And beyond that?
We think that then we settle into a neutral level and it could be there for a while.
In other words, the belly of the curve is suggesting that rate cuts could be coming to an end. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, once again. I know I'm a broken record here. Traders were waiting on the Fed. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All right. Tell the truth here. Before the financial crisis and the Great Recession, did you know what a mortgage-backed security was? Had you ever heard of a credit default swap? If I'd have asked you whether Lehman Brothers was an investment bank or a chain of auto body shops, which would you have guessed? Well, investment bank, probably most of you. But the point is, every bubble has its own jargon and its own terms of art that, when things are bubbling up, they become common parlance on Wall Street. After things pop, though, all that jargon makes its way into our Main Street vocabulary. And you can perhaps guess where I'm going here. There's plenty of debate about whether we're even in an AI bubble, let alone its popability. But just in case things do go south, Marketplace's Matt Levin has three early candidates for the bubble buzzwords we hope you are not going to be learning in the near future.
Just to reassure you a bit, very few experts I interviewed think we're on the precipice of some global economic meltdown like the Great Recession. But on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being I'm getting major 2008 heebie-jeebies here, just how worried are those experts?
I'd say I think it's between 5 to 7.
I'll say probably 7 or 8 at least.
I'm probably in the middle of that range, at a 4 or a 5.
Okay, so maybe not that reassuring. Gil Luria at the investment firm D.A. Davidson, the 4 or a 5 guy, says if things do go haywire, you'll probably hear these words a lot.
Special purpose vehicle.
Special purpose vehicle, or SPV as the cool kids call it. Even very rich tech companies sometimes need to borrow money to build an AI data center. So when Meta announced it was building a nearly $30 billion data center in Louisiana earlier this year, it wasn't surprising there was lots of debt involved.
Now, this isn't Meta borrowing the money.
Technically, it's a special purpose vehicle borrowing the money, a separate legal entity Meta co-created with a private investment firm. Meta is agreeing to rent the data center.
So that would be like you buying a house, but not taking the mortgage yourself, but having somebody else take the mortgage, which from your perspective is great.
But from a broader economic perspective, maybe not so great. The fraudulent energy company Enron was a big fan of special purpose vehicles. Now, there's nothing inherently illegal about SPVs, but if demand to use that Louisiana data center falls short of expectations...
It's Meta borrowing money without borrowing money, and at the end of the day, somebody's going to be left holding the bag.
Which brings us to AI bubble buzzword number two.
Private credit.
Advait Aaron is at the Center for Public Enterprise. He was the 5 to 7 guy on the doomsday scale. Private credit is basically investment firms like hedge funds and private equity lending money to businesses, like a bank would. Except they're not regulated like banks.
I don't even think Americans are necessarily unfamiliar with this concept. We might have even heard of it previously as a shadow bank.
That data center in Louisiana Meta is building with that special purpose vehicle, a private credit firm is throwing in billions, which is the case for a lot of AI financing.
These chips that companies like NVIDIA make, they help those tech companies buy those chips, and they help the data center developers take out long-term debt or construction debt to build the data centers themselves.
If the AI bubble goes pop, private credit will be hit pretty hard. That's bad news for the pension funds whose money private credit firms invest, but it could also be bad news for actual non-shadow banks.
So banks are actually funding private credit and are getting some amount of returns from private credit, and private credit uses banks' funding to go and raise other debt or other capital and goes and makes their risky bets.
Private credit, special purpose vehicle, admittedly, these buzzwords sound so boring. Isn't there a new, sexy, sci-fi sounding word that better befits a bubble tied to super intelligent robots?
Neocloud is a term that people might come to know.
Ooh, neocloud. Paul Kudrowski is a fellow at the MIT Institute for the Digital Economy. He was the expert most worried about the AI bubble. Neoclouds are tech companies that basically rent out AI chips to tech firms and often take out loans against the chips they're renting out.
These neocloud providers have very high debt loads, much of it at high yields, much of it that has to be turned over on a 4-year, 5-year basis. And so they're a very risky bunch.
CoreWeave is probably the most famous of the neoclouds. It started as a cryptocurrency company.
The analogy I sometimes make is they're like some of the more aggressive mortgage providers during the financial crisis who showed up to do only ninja loans, no income, no job, no asset loans.
There's already some signs neocloud companies are struggling. The price of insurance against CoreWeave defaulting on its debt went up by nearly 60% in 2 months. By the way, that insurance, well, it has a familiar name, credit default swaps. Remember those? Yeah, I tried to forget them too. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
What could possibly go wrong? We are going to be doing some coverage the next couple of months, the general gist of which will be, tell me if this sounds familiar, AI. Too big to fail? Let us know what you want to know at marketplace.org. As we've said a couple of times the past couple of days on this program, we are never going to get the jobs report for October. That data has vanished into the black hole of the government shutdown, never to be seen again. We did, though, this morning get a slice of labor market data for the 10th month of the year in the form of the October JOLTS, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. Help wanted ads climbed to a 5-month high. That's good. Layoffs were up too, though, and people were less likely to change jobs. And more top of mind, given the calendar, the outplacement firm Challenger Green Christmas says announced job cuts in retail are up nearly 140% from the same period last year. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has the holiday retail cautionary tale.
Last year, David Swartz, an analyst at Morningstar, toured a new warehouse that Ulta, the cosmetics chain, had recently opened.
And there's very few people working in there. The people are sort of there to monitor the machines.
The robots are efficient. They can unload, organize, and pack. From self-checkout at stores to AI at corporate headquarters, technology saves money. Considering wages typically make up something like half of retailers' operating costs. And relying on machines means there's less seasonal hiring fuss.
Even the robot workers can be laid off to some degree when they're not needed.
This is the future of retail, says Steve Hockman at Nagarro.
We call it, in fancy terms, the great decoupling.
Usually in business, when revenue grows, hiring grows. There's more money to invest and expand.
But this holiday season, what we're seeing is a separation of those two trends.
Meaning now, even when a retailer's revenue increases, hiring typically falls. Companies are investing in other areas, like those robots, instead of in their headcount. Especially this year, brands have leaned hard into automation because of uncertainty in the economy, even though the holidays are kind of the worst time for job cuts. John Talbot teaches marketing at Indiana University.
For years, larger retailers have mostly avoided any form of layoffs during the holiday season. For, 15 years now, it's just bad press.
Because reporters like me are watching extra closely. Still, Target and Amazon have announced layoffs in the last several months. Talbot says between low consumer sentiment and tariffs, every dollar counts.
This is an odd year. I definitely think it's an odd year.
He says even if consumers spend like crazy, it'll at most slow the trend a tad. Inevitably, the great retail labor reshuffling is here. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
I mentioned layoffs were up in October overall. In the information industry specifically, October a year ago, there were 34,000 layoffs. October this year, 48,000. This past September, we heard from Archit, who'd been laid off from his tech job back at the start of the year, around the same time that his parents were laid off too. So we got him back on the phone to hear how he and the family are faring.
I've been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to interview at a bunch of places and get a couple of offers and be able to choose between them. But that process has kind of taught me a lot about the job market as it currently is. I started interviewing in October after again putting in over 100 applications, but almost all of my interviews were to referrals. My first offer was actually at a startup, but it ended up, the pay was so low that out of respect, or I guess myself, I just couldn't take that job because you're not even paying me a livable wage. Then it was a large Fortune 500 company. The thing with them is they're economically doing pretty poorly. And as I joined, I'm hearing news that they might do layoffs next year, and it's unclear what the future of the company is. So then that adds like a whole other layer. And even when I'm getting these offers, the economy weirdly doesn't feel stable enough that even if I start working, and I am working at one of these companies, that the opportunity is guaranteed for that long. Pretty much every parent I know between me and my friends who's in technology is laid off right now. My dad, he hasn't been able to find anything. And my mom, I think she just burnt out and she just isn't interested in looking anymore. So I see hope in the horizon in the sense that I think I will probably be able to get another job if I get laid off, but I don't really know anything about what's going to happen with my parents at the moment. And I don't really know the wider industry. Like, for people who are less fortunate than me, I wouldn't blame them for not having hope, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Archit, newly re-employed in the tech sector out in Phoenix, Arizona. Coming up.
And so when people are saying that they're going to get Botox, it might not be Botox.
Little did you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 179 today, 0.4%, closed at 47,560. The Nasdaq notched up 30 points, 0.1%, 23,576. The S&P 500 declined 6 points, about a 10%, 68.40. Cosmetics retailer Ulta Beauty, which Kristen mentioned, had a glow up to the tune of 2.3%. Target crept up 0.6%. Macy's rose 2%. Walmart climbed 1.3%. Costco wholesale added 0.1%. Today, Campbell's reports today sales are down due to President Trump's tariffs, especially on the steel and aluminum that they need to make those iconic cans. The company also doesn't want to raise prices too much in this, and this is a quote, critical soup season. Campbell's sank 5.2% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
The numbers is supported by Odoo.com, your entire business on one platform. Marketplace is supported by Drexel University, whose cooperative education program provides students with opportunities to explore future careers and gain professional experience before graduation. More at drexel.edu. And by JumpCloud, simplifying IT through its intelligent, unified AI-backed platform that securely connects users to any resource from any device anywhere. JumpCloud, helping organizations prepare for AI acceleration.
Support for KQED comes from Mark Feringer's Nutcracker Suites in person at the Cowell Theater, a magical hour of dance, storytelling with live music for children of all ages, now through the 21st in San Francisco, tickets at fortmason.org, and from Postman. Used by over 40 million developers, Postman offers a platform where teams build APIs to help AI agents and humans make smarter decisions from design to delivery. More information at postman.com. Good afternoon. It's 4:19. I'm Michelle Hennigan. Julie Depesch will be here with your traffic update after Marketplace. And then at 4:30 on All Things Considered, thousands of people in Lagos, Nigeria have had their homes abruptly seized and destroyed, with some residents crushed inside their homes. That story is ahead in the first part of All Things Considered. The program starts at 4:30 here on KQED News.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Some news now from the world of small business, which I will set up by pointing out that according to the Small Business Administration, that's businesses with 500 employees or less account for give or take 2/3 of all new jobs in this economy. With that in mind, then, this. According to the most recent survey by the National Federation of Independent Business, first of all, and you probably expected this one, uncertainty is creeping up. It's up 3 points since October. That said, though, and uncertain though they are, small business owners remain optimistic, more optimistic than the historical average, in fact. Marketplace's Carla Javier squares that circle.
At Latchkey, a record store in South Philly, sales are up 60% this year, says owner Mark Folletti.
That's no joke. We feel really good about that.
That lines up with the latest survey of entrepreneurs like him.
Small businesses are generally doing really well in current economic conditions.
That's NFIB's Holly Wade. At the same time, she says, uncertainty is high. Hiring remains a concern, and inflation is affecting them too.
Especially in this last survey, where we saw far more small businesses saying that they raised prices in the last quarter.
Still, somehow, small business owners like Mark Folletti are optimistic.
I'm probably 58% optimistic. Not quite maybe 60%, but more optimistic than pessimistic.
One potential explanation comes from John Arensmeyer of Small Business Majority.
If you're crazy enough to start and run a small business, you are by definition a very optimistic person.
His company did its own survey of small businesses too and found...
What is different from the past is that the optimism and pessimism numbers are very close.
He says small businesses have been challenged by tariffs, increasing healthcare costs, and immigration operations. Erica Tapp-Duran works with owners through the Temple University Small Business Development Center. She says they're doing okay, but are nervous.
They don't necessarily have deep capital reserves or access to large lines of credit. So the flow of commerce needs to be moving at a pretty good clip in order to keep operations sustainable.
Back at Latchkey, Mark Folletti says for now, he's leaning into used records and taking a hit on margins.
If I thought we were in this situation forever, where we were going to have tariffs and tumultuousness and total unpredictability, that might be a different ballgame.
Instead, he quit his other full-time job in hopes that next year at the store is as strong as last one was. I'm Carla Javier for Marketplace.
Love it or hate it, since its debut as a cosmetic treatment in 2002, Botox has become a household name, synonymous with the anti-aging hopes of millions. Sales match those hopes, too, $2.7 billion last year in the cosmetics space. That said, Botox and its parent company are not enjoying the same prosperity they once did from that injectable. Madison Muller covers health and healthcare for Bloomberg, where she wrote about brand Botox. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I would like you to tell me, please, how you came to this story.
So I am one of our healthcare reporters here at Bloomberg, and that means I have the privilege of covering AbbVie, which is a pharmaceutical company, and AbbVie is the maker of Botox. And one of the things that I've noticed over the last couple of quarters is that Botox was repeatedly missing analysts' estimates in terms of sales. And that to me was surprising because here in New York, it seems like everyone has Botox.
I'm in LA, Madison. I'm in LA here.
You get it too. Yeah. You get it, right. And so I was like, this doesn't make sense. Something doesn't add up. And I dug a little bit more into it, and that's sort of how I got into this story.
So what's going on? I mean, we talked a little bit about, not you and I, but somebody else, about med spas, you know, sort of these mm-hmm. days, you know, and people going to get touch-ups or what have you. It's not like Botox isn't being used more, or is it? What's the deal?
That is sort of the mystery that was part of this story. So the thing is, there are different types of neurotoxins now on the market. So Botox is the one that everyone's most familiar with, but Botox isn't the actual class of medications. And so there are other products on the market. There's one called Dysport. There's one called Xeomin. Mm. But it's like Kleenex. You know, everyone right. uses the word Botox to just describe the treatment. And so when people are saying that they're going to get Botox, it might not be Botox. And AbbVie or Allergan has really started to lose out on market share to some of these competitors.
Allergan and now AbbVie, they are not the first company to lose market share with their flagship product. What are they doing to bring it back?
So they are launching a pretty big marketing campaign, and one of those events I actually got to go to here in New York. It was an event called Naturally You, and this was more focused on filler, actually, which is a separate problem. Mm-hmm. But it shows the sort of consumer activation that AbbVie is doing right now to get consumers and customers back on their side, making sure that people know, you know, they've been around for so long. There's lots of studies, super safe, and it has a ton of different approved uses for, you know, different types of lines and, right. and signs of aging all over your face.
For all the approved uses and the safeness of it, Naturally You is somewhat ironic in that conference title, yeah?
Yeah. Exactly. Right. But I think that's a big part of this is one of the reasons that people are shying away from cosmetic treatments at this moment is because there's a more natural look that's
right,
in.
Right,
I
right.
mean, if you think about celebrities like Pam Anderson and you know, you're in LA, you're there with all the right. celebrities, they're embracing aging. And so people are scared of looking unnatural. And that's one of the things that AbbVie is contending with. And so they have a new product that's called Trenibot E, and it's a faster acting neurotoxin. So it wears off within a couple of weeks. And so they're hoping that, you know, if people like them, they'll come back and just start getting Botox.
You got to innovate, man. You got to innovate. I will close mm-hmm. here, and I'm not outing you because you actually put this in Bloomberg. You know whereof you speak.
Well, so, I mean, part of this also came from my personal experience of I am on TV sometimes here at Bloomberg and was like, wow, I'm this job is aging me. I'm really getting some forehead wrinkles here.
You should try radio. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly. And so I went to a med spa here in New York and really liked the results. I was going for probably 2 years and one day looked over to, you know, at the needle and the vial that they're injecting into my face and saw that it was not Botox as I thought that it was for the past 2 years. It was Dysport, which is a different product. And I think that sort of illustrates what is happening. And a lot of people maybe don't realize mm-hmm. that there was anything really going wrong at AbbVie at all, just because Botox is so ubiquitous and everyone knows what it is.
Yeah. Madison Muller at Bloomberg. Madison, thanks a bunch. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Wealth Enhancement, providing its Wealth Blueprint, a plan that integrates retirement, investing, taxes, and estate planning into one plan. Learn more at wealthenhancement.com/blueprint. And by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
This final note on the way out today, which, you know, grain of salt. Bloomberg has the story that SpaceX is moving ahead with plans for an initial public offering. Mid to late 2026 is the time frame. The valuation is the interesting part. $1.5 trillion, says Bloomberg. The grain of salt attaches not to the story, but to the guy running the company, Elon Musk's penchant for overpromising and delivering very, very late. Are very well documented. Jordan Manji, Zonil Maharaj, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, and Virginia K. Smith work on the digital team around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
And this is KQED News. Marketplace comes on again this evening at 6:30. All Things Considered starts after a look at traffic, including trouble in Palo Alto. Here's Julie Depesh.
Dealing with a stall now on North 101 before University Avenue. You'll see that car blocking the far left lane. We've got a big rig crash in San Jose heading southbound 101. It's after the 280-680 interchange. All the activity should be on the right shoulder. And new trouble in Novato, North 101 before Ignacio Boulevard. SUV and a pickup truck mixed it up. Both made it to the shoulder. Julie Deppisch for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Glime the Jeweler. Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Apocalypse in the Tropics. The documentary by Petra Costa investigates the fast rise of the evangelical movement in Brazil and the consequences for politics and democracy. Now on Netflix, awards eligible. And from Silicon Valley Community Foundation, raising urgent funds needed to support local nonprofits as low-income residents' access to food, shelter, health care, and other essential services is at risk. Learn more at svcf.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This segment about what's coming up later in the show is exactly 30 seconds long.
30 seconds here on Earth.
But time moves just a bit faster on Mars.
Since Mars is farther out than the Earth, the gravitational pull of the Sun is much lesser, and therefore the clocks are going to tick faster.
First news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump remains bullish about the U.S. economy as more and more public polls show voters blame him for high prices and rising inflation. This comes 11 months into Trump's second term in office when he promised to fix the affordability problems. In this one-on-one with Politico, the reporter here asks the president about the current state of the economy.
I wonder what grade you would give
A plus.
Economy. A plus.
Yeah, A plus, 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 plus.
Trump has called affordability a Democratic con job and a hoax, but recent layoffs and stubbornly high prices have left consumers feeling uneasy. Trump is holding a rally in Pennsylvania at this hour to talk about the economy as his approval ratings have hit an all-time low and White House officials are asking voters for patience. Florida's governor has designated a Muslim civil rights group as a foreign terrorist organization. The Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, plans to sue Governor Ron DeSantis. From member station WUSF, Nancy Goyne has more.
During a news conference in Tampa Tuesday, CARE Florida leader Hiba Rahim denied any ties to extremist groups.
Your designation has no basis in law or fact.
She called the move a stunt. But speaking in North Miami Beach, the governor said he welcomes the lawsuit as a way to subpoena records from CARE.
They have every right to sue, and then we're going to have a right to get the information that we need to make sure.
CARE's Rahim says the group isn't worried about handing over their financial records or any other information. Only the federal government can designate a group as a foreign terrorist organization. CARE does not have that federal designation. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Guan in Tampa, Florida.
A mixed day of trading on Wall Street. This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. The man accused of fatally stabbing a social worker at San Francisco General Hospital last week missed his arraignment date today because he's being held for psychiatric care. Wilfredo Tortolero Ariachi was said to be arraigned on a murder charge after the attack last Friday in the hospital's long-term HIV clinic. Deputy Public Defender Sylvia Nguyen will represent him.
He is currently hospitalized due to his mental status. The court has just appointed our office to represent him. I obviously need to have time to review the materials, and even more importantly, I need to have time to meet with him.
The hearing was postponed to next week. Oakland officials today announced that the city has sold over $330 million in general obligation bonds. KQED's Alex Hall reports it's good news for the chronically cash-strapped city.
The bond sale is expected to provide Oakland with capital funding for things like paving roads, renovating parks, libraries, and senior centers, and investing in affordable housing. Mayor Barbara Lee called it a sign that financial markets have confidence in the direction Oakland is heading.
When the financial market believes in Oakland's direction and in Oakland, that helps us fund the work that the residents deserve and need.
Voters authorized the city to issue bonds for infrastructure projects back in 2022, but officials delayed because of concerns over the city's downgraded credit rating. Officials say funds from the bonds should become available within the next 2 weeks. I'm Alex Hall, KQED News.
And I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from Oakland San Francisco Bay Airport. Beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for KQED comes from Post, Peninsula Open Space Trust. Post has protected and cared for more than 93,000 acres of open space on the peninsula and in the South Bay for the benefit of all. Learn more at openspacetrust.org. And from Second Harvest of Silicon Valley, providing nutritious food to 1 in 6 people in Santa Clara and San Mateo counties. Learn more at shfb.org. It's going to be mostly clear tonight with lows in the 40s. Tomorrow will be foggy in the morning and sunny in the afternoon. And there is a high risk of sneaker waves at the beach. Highs tomorrow will be in the 60s for the Bay region. Sacramento will be foggy all day tomorrow with a high of 46. Support for NPR comes from MS Now, home to the Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Here on Earth, we take for granted the fact that my watch displays the same time as everybody else's watch does, at least within my time zone. And when you step back and think about it, it is kind of amazing that the whole world can sync up our clocks like that. But it is a lot more complicated to sync up a clock here on Earth with, say, a clock on Mars. And that is because time passes differently depending on where you are in the universe and depending on the gravitational field you're in. Luckily for us, physicists at the National Institute of Standards and Technology have done the math so we don't have to, and they have figured out just how much faster a clock ticks on Mars. Bijanat Patla is the co-author of a paper all about that out this month in the Astronomical Journal and joins me now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me on.
Let's just get right to it. How much faster do clocks tick on Mars than Earth?
The clocks on Mars, on average, would tick 477 microseconds per day faster than clocks on Earth.
How can I even begin to think of a microsecond?
This is a millionth of a second, and it's approximately the time it takes light to travel 300 meters.
Okay. So why is it? I mean, like, I generally understand the concepts of why time is relative in different places, but why is it exactly that a clock is going to go faster on Mars than Earth?
So the distance from the sun of Mars is way greater than it is on Earth. As you go farther out into the solar system, the gravitational pull of the sun decreases dramatically. And therefore, since Mars is farther out than the Earth, the gravitational pull of the sun is much lesser, and therefore the clocks are going to tick faster.
So I think Einstein's theory of relativity is like a pop culture thing that people at least know the phrase, if not the details, the general idea that gravity affects the passage of time. I'm wondering, do these calculations that you've been working on, do they add anything to that conversation? Is there something new here to think about and learn more about?
This calculation provides a framework where we can test general relativity within the inner solar system, because there is a general consensus within the community that quantum mechanics and general relativity are incompatible. And this kind of clocks on different planets would allow us to put constraints on the limitations of general relativity, or to check whether is there any fundamental connection between quantum mechanics and relativity.
I find this really interesting. I like Mars. I like the general idea of space-time. But is there a practical use for this, or is this one step towards something very practical for the scientific community to have a better sense of now that you figured this out?
The practical aspect comes from, if you want to translate the communication infrastructure that we have on Earth to Mars, then we'll have to have the clock synchronized pretty accurately.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to have multiple robots and scale up the operation, then the robots have to talk to each other. And therefore, we'll have to have a different way to communicate. And that's where the calculation comes into play. if we are envisioning to becoming an interplanetary species.
That is Bijanette Patla, a theoretical physicist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I know that right now, at least, we're just talking Earth to Earth, but I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Over the past month, close to 10,000 people have been forcefully evicted from a riverside community in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos. Now, mass evictions are a recurring story in Africa's most populous city. Advocates say that these homes are being displaced by luxury developments. And as NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports, these displacements are often marked by deadly violence.
In Lagos, evictions can mean more than having to leave your home. It can mean watching it crumble, destroyed without notice, like thousands of residents along a stretch of waterfront communities. Bulldozers in Oworonsoki, a community on the edge of the Lagos Lagoon, crushed thousands of concrete structures and shanties, many which had been there for decades. And despairing residents watch on, powerless to stop it.
It's just like a dream. I wish it's a dream.
Esther Lawal is a 44-year-old mother of three, standing in the rubble of her demolished home with her 8-year-old son.
This is my kitchen. I'll cook here every day for my children.
For 11 years, she and her family lived in a 3-bedroom flat she built with her late husband.
What I worked for years, me and my husband, they use a minute to destroy all those things.
All her savings went into building the home, which was destroyed in just minutes, she says. Nearby, 66-year-old Kunle Ogunbowale is bereft. He wanders around in circles around the ruins of his home, wailing and crying out to anyone who will listen. I'm elderly, he says in Yoruba. What work can I do now to survive? They are slowly killing us. Even by the violent standards of mass demolitions in Nigeria, the evictions in Oworonsoki have been brutal. Desperate residents search through smoldering heaps of charred furniture and clothes, slowly moving through a fog of smoke. One of them, simply called Blessing, speaks in Pidgin and tells me moments ago, police officers came and torched what was left of the site. They even burnt the belongings she'd salvaged and kept in a heap near her home. More than 10 residents have died in the demolitions, according to community leaders. Some were unable to leave their homes before they were crushed. At least one died of a suspected heart attack. The residents blame the Lagos state government and a local traditional ruler, Oba Saliu Babatunde, who they say is keen to develop luxury apartments. This week, dozens of residents held a protest outside the state government office in Lagos.
They did everything they were supposed to do, and what is happening is that they're being chased out.
Megan Chapman founded the Justice and Empowerment Initiative, an NGO supporting evicted communities. They helped the community take the government to the Lagos High Court and won an injunction stopping any evictions until the residents were consulted and rehoused. But the injunction was ignored.
They were supposed to be consulted with and resettled before any demolition should happen. But what we're seeing in this country, unfortunately, is that the rule of law is not being respected.
The government has said compensation claims in Oworonsoki are being processed, with residents paid only about $150. But the community claim none of them have received any money. Millions across Lagos worry they will face a similar fate. Up to 75% of the city's 20 million people live in informal housing, according to the World Bank. And some have nowhere else to go. Dozens of worshippers sing at the demolished site of the Christ Glory Church. The walls and roof have crumbled, but for now, a small congregation has remained, holding a service surrounded by rubble. They are one of several communities who were rooted here, but who must now contemplate what comes next. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. There's big news today for millions of federal student loan borrowers. The U.S. Department of Education says it's reached a proposed settlement. It would end a Biden-era repayment plan that has been tied up in the courts for more than a year. NPR's Corey Turner has been following the story and joins us now. Hi, Corey.
Hello.
Before we get to the news of the settlement, remind us what this repayment plan was and why it ended up in court.
Yeah, it's the Saving on a Valuable Education plan, but it's better known as SAVE. It was the most flexible and generous of all the income-driven repayment plans. It promised fast-tracked loan forgiveness, monthly payments as low as $0 for low-income borrowers. But it turns out, Scott, it was so generous that Republican state attorneys general sued the Biden administration, arguing in court it was too generous, mm-hmm. and that if Congress had wanted to create a plan like this, it would have. And so SAVE has been in legal limbo ever since. Now, though, you know, President Trump's Education Department agrees with those Republican AGs, and so they appear to have cut a deal. Undersecretary of Education Nicholas Kent said in a statement announcing the proposed settlement today, quote, American taxpayers can now rest assured they will no longer be forced to serve as collateral for illegal and irresponsible student loan policies.
Probably a lot of people listening who are enrolled in the SAVE plan. What do they need to know?
Well, they're in good company. There are about 7 million borrowers still in SAVE. So this agreement is a big deal pending court approval. It's also worth saying many of these borrowers haven't had to make payments in years because of the legal limbo I just mentioned, during which they didn't have to make payments, but that followed on the heels of the long pandemic payment pause. Not only, though, is this going to be a financial stretch for many borrowers, it's going to be a huge logistical challenge for the servicing companies that manage the federal student loan portfolio. I was talking earlier today with Scott Buchanan. He's head of the Student Loan Servicing Alliance, and he told me it's going to be bumpy. That was his word. He said SAVE borrowers are going to have a ton of questions. They will need a ton of hand-holding to get back into repayment. And part of the problem here is the options available to them are a little murky. Republicans' One Big Beautiful Bill Act created two new repayment plans, but they're not going to roll out till July, which is too late for this purposes of SAVE borrowers now. Meanwhile, borrower advocates were sounding the alarm today. Here's Persis Yu with the group Protect Borrowers.
The reality is that the SAVE plan was created because the other plans were unaffordable for millions of borrowers. So many borrowers are going to be in the difficult spot of making this decision about whether or not to stay current on their loans or feed their families and keep a roof over their head.
And Scott, this settlement lands at a time when millions of other borrowers are already way behind on their loan payments.
Yeah, do we have a sense of what exactly is going on there?
Yeah, according to the latest tranche of data from the Education Department, some 12 million borrowers are either really behind on their payments or already in default. That's at least a quarter of all federal student loan borrowers. And everybody I talk to on both sides of the aisle here say this is a crisis. And now we're talking about how to get these 7 million SAVE borrowers, many of whom are low income, back into repayment. This is going to be an incredible test for the department and obviously for these borrowers. And my best advice right now to these borrowers is to go to studentaid.gov and start reading up on the other repayment plans out there so you know what your options are.
That is NPR education correspondent Corey Turner. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Your KQED traffic update at 4:48 starts in San Francisco. Here's Julie Deppish.
Yeah, just a fender bender there, heading southbound 101 after Paul Avenue. We've got a couple of vehicles over on the right-hand shoulder up to Novato for that wreck, North 101 before Ignacio Boulevard. SUV and a pickup truck, they're out of the lanes. We have a problem in San Jose heading westbound 237. It's after Zanker Road, that two-vehicle crash, not blocking, they're over on the shoulder. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy explore the global impact of the Cold War for the Cold War and its legacies. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu and from visitorscoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com.
Clinics are popping up all over offering ketamine in a variety of settings for depression, for anxiety, for chronic pain. There isn't a real standardized approach to how to treat someone using ketamine. Experts kind of describe this moment as the Wild West. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm a health correspondent for KQED. You can find my story about ketamine at kqed.org.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on Political Breakdown, severe threats to federal funding for programs aimed at helping the homeless are causing near panic in California, which stands to lose hundreds of millions of dollars if the cuts go through. Experts say the cuts would reverse progress made, getting the most vulnerable people off the streets and into permanent housing. It's Political Breakdown on KQED News at 5:50 today and wherever you get your podcasts.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Breast cancer among men is rare but real. Now the Veterans Administration is making it harder for male veterans with breast cancer to get care and disability benefits. The agency says the Biden administration improperly classified men's breasts as reproductive organs, but critics say cancer patients are getting caught up in the Trump administration's war on gender ideology. WUNC's Jay Price reports.
Breast cancer was among several illnesses the VA had considered presumptive under the PACT Act of 2022. That law had made it easier for veterans who got sick after exposure to burn pit smoke or other toxins to get benefits, because certain illnesses were automatically presumed to be connected to military service. The law allows the VA to add illnesses to the list as new data emerges, and under President Biden, the VA had added male breast cancer under reproductive cancers, the same category that female breast cancer fell under. But now the VA has removed it. The policy change, which was first reported by ProPublica, went into effect September 30th and requires male veterans with breast cancer to not only document that they were exposed to toxins, but also to prove that those toxins caused the disease. The change applies only to men, not women.
That's a real head-scratcher.
Terry Ballinger, a veteran of the first Gulf War, was diagnosed with breast cancer last year.
I mean, everybody in oncology is highly confident that male breast cancer and female breast cancer are virtually identical. They're identical in the way that they're diagnosed and the way that they're treated.
Ballinger filed his disability claim when male breast cancer was still considered presumptive. Even so, he needed a lawyer to get the VA to approve it. Ballinger says he was exposed to a wide range of toxins in the Army, including asbestos, depleted uranium, burn pit smoke, and the choking clouds from burning oil wells. With no family history or known genetic predisposition to breast cancer, he says his service-related exposures are the most obvious culprit.
I don't want to say it has to be, but all, you know, if you start eliminating possibilities, you end up coming back to that.
In a written statement, a VA spokesman said the Biden administration had, quote, falsely classified male breast cancer when the VA put it under illnesses of the reproductive system. Critics, including several Democratic members of Congress, say the change stems from President Trump's executive order that bans gender ideology in the federal government. That order says policies must treat men and women as biologically different. The members of Congress wrote a letter to the VA saying the policy change distorts science for politics. Dr. Ben Park is a leading breast cancer researcher.
So the vast majority of male breast cancer biologically is in fact reflective of the most common type of breast cancer in women.
He said it's irrational to use semantics about gender to treat male and female breast cancer patients differently.
That would be like, let's not treat colon cancer in men, but we'll treat it in women. That doesn't make sense to me.
Male breast cancer accounts for fewer than 1% of all cases of breast cancer, but studies suggest it's more common and more lethal among veterans. The VA says it diagnoses about 100 cases a year. Activist Mike Partain helped lobby successfully to make sure the PACT Act included benefits for people exposed to toxic water at Camp Lejeune. He was born on the base while his father was a Marine there and later developed breast cancer. Partain called the policy change disturbing and said it worsens what he regards as a serious flaw in the law, that it already didn't list breast cancer as presumptive for toxic exposures occurring in the United States, including at Lejeune.
We were seeing so many men with breast cancer popping up at Camp Lejeune. When I was tracking it, I had gotten over about 125 men that had the single commonality of male breast cancer and exposure to the contaminated water.
He says if an illness like male breast cancer isn't considered presumptive for military-related exposures, the odds that the VA will approve a claim for it are low. In its statement, the VA said it will continue to provide care and benefits for male breast cancer patients who already receive them, as well as for new claimants who can prove a service connection. The Democratic members of Congress are asking the VA to reverse the new policy and be more transparent about benefits changes. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Durham, North Carolina.
The latest poll by the National Alliance for Mental Illness finds that 1 in 5 American adults rate their mental health as poor, and a majority of them are opposed to cuts to federal jobs and to federal funding for programs addressing mental health, substance use, and suicide prevention. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports.
The NAMI Ipsos poll asked more than 2,000 adults across the country about their own mental health, as well as the state of mental health care in the country. Hannah Waslowski is chief advocacy officer at NAMI.
If you think about it, 1 in 5 saying their mental health is poor right now is deeply concerning.
She says respondents identified a range of factors affecting their well-being.
Being a caregiver is really taking a drain on people's mental health, financial uncertainty, the state of the world. So all of these things are really taking a toll.
The poll also asked respondents about their thoughts on whether lawmakers are doing enough to address mental health needs in the country.
Nearly 2 in 3 Americans say that they don't think Congress is doing enough about mental health. They also say they're dedicating too little resources to mental health care.
She points out the cuts to the country's main federal mental health agency, which has lost nearly half of its 900 employees this year due to the Trump administration's efforts to cut federal spending. But nearly 3/4 of poll respondents are opposed to such cuts to federal staffing and programs for mental health, substance use, and suicide prevention, like the 988 Lifeline.
It is hard to find an issue where Americans agree strongly, but we see again and again in these polls that Americans think that mental health, suicide prevention, 988 should be among the highest priorities for Congress in terms of dedicating federal funding.
The poll's results aren't surprising, says psychologist Benjamin Miller.
What we saw in those data from the survey is what a lot of people have been saying for years.
Miller, an adjunct at Stanford University, wasn't involved in the new poll. He says people in communities across the country have been struggling to access mental health care for themselves and their loved ones.
It's frustrating, it's expensive, and it's often not what you want when you want it. So people see this brokenness, and they don't believe that our leaders are seriously thinking about fixing it.
He says the cuts to Medicaid passed in President Trump's budget bill and higher health insurance costs will only worsen access to care for mental health and substance use. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From ARM, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on ARM, ARM.com. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older, nprwineclub.org, and from the listeners of KQED. In Boulder, Colorado, high schoolers are learning trades by building affordable housing. A report on this first-of-its-kind partnership with Habitat for Humanity is ahead in the next part of All Things Considered. Right now, let's get your traffic update starting in Napa. Here's Julie Depish.
And we still do have a traffic alert there on Highway 29, southbound, shut down between Soskill Ferry Road and Highway 221. This overturned big rig, a leaking hydraulic fluid. New crash Santa Rosa, northbound 101 at Highway 12. Got four vehicles in the middle lanes, backing up to Baker. And coming off the San Mateo Bridge into Hayward, eastbound 92 before Industrial Boulevard. Big rig and a car got into it, both on the right shoulder. Julie Depish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Picture House, presenting The Tale of Silly Ann, a story of resilience and a powerful connection between a down-on-his-luck farmer and a wounded wife.